let's start off. We know the basic parts of the Seder, more or less. Kadesh Shochatz, Kadesh Shochatz. Good. Right, so let me raise an interesting question. The first two, Kadesh Shochatz. So one might claim that the order of Kadesh Shochatz is a little bit surprising. Right? Now, there are a lot of reasons why we make Kiddush first, obviously. That's what we normally do. We make Kiddush and then we wash our hands, right? This washing has a special washing hands, as we know, right, for the Karpas. So I'd just like to draw your attention. Moshe Feinstein points out a couple things, and we have a couple rules, a couple principles in halacha that would make the Kadesh Ruchatz seem possibly out of order and need of explanation. So he says, first of all, we have a pasuk from Tehillim. David Melch tells us, Sur Meira. General principle, very good. A general principle in Avodas Hashem is Sur Meira, veer away from the evil, right? Get the evil out of there. And do the good. Excellent. We have another principle. You know the similar principle? Tovel, v'sheretz biado. Tovel, tvila, you're the mikvah. And the sheretz, the source of tuma, the little creepy crawly.
Yeah.
Is in your hand. If you're holding something that's making you tummy, right, like a dead body part, or a sheretz, and you go into the mikvah, and you leave the mikvah, creepy crawly, and you walk out of the mikvah, and you're still holding the sheretz, are you tummy or tahor?
Tummy.
You're still tummy. You didn't do anything, right? You didn't disconnect from the source of the
tumor.
Right, so you didn't surera. So therefore, it would make more sense when it comes to Avodas Hashem to first get rid of the evil, get rid of the isurim in your life, and the bad midos, and the bad stuff, the negative stuff. Sur meira, get rid of the tumah. And then asay tov, and then purify yourself. In other words, first urchatz. At that point, I guess it would be richatz, right? And then kadesh, then sanctify yourself by adding mitzvahs and good deeds, etc., etc. That would seem to make more sense. Why is it not that way? I think Avi's going to add something to our...
No, I have a question.
What
would yekis do? Because yekis normally do, they normally wash it.
It's for bread. It's for bread. So once again, good. Right, 100%. That, by the way, the Gemara for that is also in the 10th parak, where the discussion for this is all from. And that's based on the Rush. They go ahead and they wash first. Then they say Kiddush, and then say Amozi. So here they follow the same seder that we do, because this urchatz is not for the bread, it's just for the karpas. Good point. Okay.
So they don't make Kiddush right before Moti Matzah?
No, they follow the same seder that everybody follows. So as far as I know, you can double check with Rav Schechter, who knows the Minhagim of I'm pretty sure, I'm not an expert in the Minhagim of
they just push it in on just what I said.
Yeah. Well, once again, it's not really true, because the washing of hands of Rachtza for the Moti Matzah so far away, right? You can't wash your hands for the bread.
No,
and
the
then this Urchat, push out the kiddush, put it out the kiddush. Okay, good. You're right. So they don't do that. They keep it here. As far as I know, double check with your local German traditionalist. Okay, great. So I'm going to give you a couple answers. You ready? Give you a couple answers. So Rav Moshe Feinstein gives a very straightforward answer. He says that, listen, in general, it's easier... So the question, once again, is why Kadesh Ruchatz? Why the positive and then the negative? Why do the good things first, sanctify yourself, and then cleanse yourself? Shouldn't it really be Sur Meira, cleanse yourself, and then Asay Tov? When should you really Ruchatz, purify yourself, and then Kadesh? So Moshe Feinstein gives the following explanation. He says that that the Balei Agadah were trying to be practical. And for most people, it's easier to go ahead and do good things, sanctify themselves by adding good deeds and adding mitzvot, than it is to get rid of the negative habits. Right? And I actually heard a beautiful idea in Hanukkah that parallels this very much so. You know there's a machloket Beit Shammai Beit Hillel. Do we lay 1 to 8? Or 8 to 1? Right? So there's reasons, the Gemara gives two reasons, you know, why they have their, why they state what they state, right? I'm sure you learned it. However, I had heard a beautiful idea from one of my teachers, Rabbi Maury Schwartz, who said that it could be that there's something of also an Avodas Hashem question that's behind the halacha, behind Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Beit Shammai, and this fits the Beit Shammai that we know, Beit Shammai's approach was, you know what you have to do? You have to take away. You have to get rid of the evil. You have to get rid of the bad habits. You have to get rid of the yisurim. You're involved in this, this, or that. Yeah, you got to get rid of it. Kedusha, you know how you reach Kedusha? 8, 7, 6, 5, by taking away. So Beit Hillel says, you know what's more practical? Most people aren't going to be able to do that. It's very hard to break bad habits. It's very hard to get rid of yisurim. You got to work on it, but it's hard. It's more practical for people to load up and add good deeds and add mitzvot and add positive things in life. And what happens is when you go to 1, to 2, to 3, and you get up to 8, by the time you get to 8, you've pushed it all. There's no time left in the day for the shtuyot because you're so happy and involved doing good things. And that might be the machloket in part of Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. And I'll give you one last idea on this concept. If I'm the Sukkot Shavuot Rebbe, the Shemi Shmuel said the name of his father, the Avni Nezer, the Sukkot Shavuot Rebbe, he feels there's another lesson here. Why Kadesh? And then Rukas, he says, because it's actually historically what happened. The Jews were very holy, or not very holy when they left Mitzrayim. They were not holy. They were not deserving. They didn't have the merit. They were Tame, as you probably are familiar with the famous Chazal, that at Kriyat Yamsuf, the angels looked down, and they saw the Jews here, and they saw the Egyptians here, and they knew Hashem was about to drown these and save these, and said, Elu ve'elu, Ogdei Avodah Zarah. What's the difference between these guys and those guys? They're all worship idols. Come on. Why are you doing a miracle for them anymore? The answer was Yaakov. What? They were on the bottom level of Tumah. So we weren't saved in Mitzrayim because we did a rechatz. So we cleansed ourselves and we purified. It doesn't mean we didn't have any merits. We had merits. We did do Korban Pesach. We did do Brit Milah. We kept our name. We kept our clothes. 100%. We did have some merits. But basically, we were way down. And Hashem said, you know, I'm going to save you anyways. So to relive that, to remember God's compassion, first we do Kadesh. Hashem says, you know what? You don't deserve it, but I'm going to lift you up. And Rechatz, you'll do the Rechatz later. You'll cleanse yourself. You've got 49 days to eat the Torah. You'll get a chance to cleanse yourself. But on the night of Purim, we remind ourselves that it's possible to reach God by first Kadesh and then Rechatz. Okay, that's as far as that. Share with you another idea. This one's from Yaakov Kamenetsky. I'm going to skip around here in a particular order. Now, let me just ask you, gentlemen, what language is the Haggadah in?
Translated from
Yiddish.
Mostly Hebrew.
I think that's true. Yeah, it's all Hebrew except for which section? Halach Ma'anya. Right. Very good. So, Halach Ma'anya is the one like little island of Aramaic in a sea of Hebrew. Now the truth is, the Hebrew, it makes sense. We understand why it's in Hebrew. I mean, after all, that was the language for the Jews when the Haggadah was put together. We don't know exactly when the Haggadah was put together. Very possibly around the period of Rabban Gamliel, the Nasi, after the destruction of the Second Temple. That's probably when the main corpus of the Haggadah was put together. There's different theories. Anyways, at that time, it would make sense. They were speaking Hebrew. Aramaic was very common. That's true. But, you know, most of the Mishnah was composed in Hebrew. Makes sense to be composed in Hebrew. So if Yaakov Kamenetsky asked a question, if that's true, why is it that we have this section, this like little island of Aramaic, Halach Ma'anya? Before you ask a question or give me an insight, if you listen to the words, it's like a question within a question. You ready? Halach Ma'anya, this is the bread of affliction, Di'achalu avatana ba'arad demitzrayim, that our forefathers ate in the land of Egypt. Kol dichven yetiv yecho, anyone who's hungry, come and eat. Kol ditzrich, anyone who's needy, yetiv yifsach, come and do the korban pesach with us. Hashata, this year, hacha, we're here in Galus, etc. L'shana haba'a, what just happened? What language? We switch back into Hebrew. Ba'ara di Yisrael, back in Aramaic. Right, next year, we'll be in the land of Israel. Hashata, this year, avde, we're slaves. L'shana haba'a, switches again. B'nei Chori, which is also Hebrew.
Aramaic term for next year, though.
It would be Shata Da'ate. Would be Shana Haba'a. Right. So the question is, why is this little section of Aramaic? And then the question within the question is, why is there this little sprinkling of Hebrew, Shana Haba'a? Okay. Yeah, we'll go in order here. Yeah. All right.
Why is Halach Ma'anya specifically in Aramaic? Does that mean it was added later?
That's exactly the question we're going to deal with. That is exactly what we're going to try to figure out. Right. So he takes the approach that it wasn't added later, that it came at the same time, and therefore why did they purposely included it in? That might be an answer also.
I've heard that Halach Ma'anya is in Aramaic because it's inviting everyone out. If that's the common language when everyone at the time, then it should be in the language people would understand, and that's why they should invite.
Okay. Very good. The truth is that even Right, so we're not exactly sure, but it seems like the main body of the Haggadah was probably around Rabban Gamliel, which would put around 120. All right, in other words, after the destruction of the temple, it could be that it was later under Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, because he's mentioned he is mentioned unless that section was added later. Right? So somewhere within the 100 or 200 years after the destruction of the temple. Okay, yeah, what did you want to say?
Maybe it's because this is kind of the Ikkari Vedanta. One of the main ideas of the Vedanta is that we were slaves back then and now we're freemen and the Shanabhavi should be in the tribes. So if there's one idea that we have to understand and we should say in the natural languages, like I said, we should be in Aramaic.
Okay.
But also the reason why there could be a little bit of hints of Hebrew is because when we move back to Israel, we have to come over to Shanabhavi or Mashiach.
Okay, good.
We speak in Hebrew.
Good. I'll buy the second one. The first one, I have a challenge for you, though. Could you get the windows for me? Get some air in there. Maybe open that door also, we'll get some cross piece. The problem with what you said, excellent, very good. The problem with the first thing you said is that if you want to mark off the most important parts in the language that a lot of people understood, and it is true that during the Second Temple, even though they started to, there was a resurgence of speaking Hebrew, Aramaic was still the international, it was the lingua franca, it was like the English of the time. Because of the Babylonian and the Persian influence, Aramaic did continue to dominate, that's true. The problem with what you said is therefore the three things that we learn, the Rambam Gamla says, if you didn't mention these three things, you're not Yotzei, should have also been in Aramaic. And that's Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. Because if you didn't read them and understand them, then you're not Yotzei. Right? So then those also, according to what you should also, but I like what you said. It's a good answer. I'm going to give you Yaakov Kamenetsky's answer, if that's okay. You ready? He has a very chadshani answer. One might even say radical. I later, though, saw it in a few other places. So he's not alone. He actually says as follows. He says that the Chachamim, at the beginning of the Second Temple, in other words, during the time of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, and throughout the Second Temple, realized that the Second Temple was a doomed project. It was not going to last. It was not going to be the final redemption. It was nothing more than a little island of redemption in a vast sea of exile. And that really what should have happened is after the destruction of the First Temple, the Jews should have gone into a very long and difficult exile. After they cleaned up everything they needed to clean up, they would have come back and rebuilt with the Mashiach the final temple. However, after a short period, 70 years, Hashem realized that the Jews were assimilating so fast that they were going to disappear. And we know that the assimilation in Bavel during the time between the First and Second Temple was rampant. It was rampant to the point that how many people returned with Ezra to rebuild the Second Commonwealth? 42,000 people, of which most of them were intermarried. They weren't even married to Jewish women, right? Most couldn't. They were not well educated. There were still well educated Jews and very religious Jews, but most of them stayed in Bavel, and the assimilation was rampant. And God realized that if I go with Plan A, there will be no Jewish people to redeem at the end. Therefore, he brought them back for a temporary connection with Hashem through the temple, but the Chachamim suspected that it was not going to last. And therefore, if you take this theory, it explains a lot of things. It explains, first of all, the fact that Aramaic stayed so important amongst the Jews, even after they were in Israel, and even after they were speaking Hebrew, that they went ahead and they had the Talmuds written. And even the Talmud Yerushalmi is in Aramaic. It's a different dialect. But it's also in Aramaic. That's why this part of the Haggadah was in Aramaic. It was basically saying, we're not free yet. We haven't arrived. Even during the time of the Second Temple, we haven't fully come home. Maybe next year, Shana Ba'ah, we will be B'nai Poim. But right now, there's still what to do. And he proves it from several points. If you take this theory, you can answer up a fantastic question. One of those questions is, you may have noticed that in the end of Sefer Yechezkel, there is a rather detailed description of the very end of Sefer Yechezkel. Which building during the times of the Yemot Mashiach? The third Beis Hamikdash. Now, he doesn't call the third Beis Hamikdash. He says, he's told, Yechezkel is told by Hashem, when the Jews go back to rebuild the temple, tell them how to build the temple. And even while they're in Chutz Laretz, have them learn this so they'll know how to build the temple. The assumption was this was going to be the temple. But when they rebuilt the second temple, you know, when Ezra and Nehemiah and they rebuilt the second temple, they didn't follow Yechezkel's plan. They didn't follow his blueprint. How can they not do that? The Navi says, this is how you build a temple. They completely ignored Yechezkel. As if he didn't... No, Herod came much later. Herod came almost 300 years later. Came much later. Yeah, he came much later. The Chashmonim ruled for 208 years, right? And that was already 150 years into the second temple. So the second temple was around for a long time. It didn't follow the blueprint. You're not allowed to go against the Navi. If you go against another, the Navi said, "This area build the temple." They didn't do it. So why did they do it? Because the Chachamim knew that this was not the temple. Yechezkel prophesied about the final temple. So when they went to rebuild the temple and they saw the Jewish people were not really ready to be fully redeemed, they didn't deserve Geula Shlema. So the Chachamim allowed them to rebuild the temple improperly, so to speak, because it was a temporary measure. It also explains a fascinating Gemara in the Yerushalmi and Rosh Hashanah, which we'll get to in 1 second. Yeah, Yoni.
Isn't there also an idea that maybe Mashiach will come if we're so bad? So why didn't they think that it's that?
I don't think they thought it was so bad. They think that the people, you know, that there was a lot of assimilation. I think they thought that the people had learned many lessons. You know, they probably weren't involved in murder anymore, and some of the Arayos, Avodah Zarah, there was, you know, an improvement, but they weren't there. They hadn't arrived. Right, which doesn't mean it couldn't have become. It doesn't mean, listen, we can always do tshuva. You know, it's not like you can't perfect things, right? But the way it was going, it seemed like this was not meant to be the third temple, the final temple, right? Which explains another thing. There's a great mystery. The Chachamim in Masechet Rosh Hashanah in the Yerushalmi allowed the Jews, when they returned with Ezra and Nehemiah, to keep the names of the Babylonian months. What month are we in right now? Adar. We're going according to Adar. Now, what name is Adar? That's not a Jewish name for the month. What's the Jewish name for this month?
It's
March.
March. Back to March again. No. No. March is an Avodah Zarah name, which has actually come from the word Mars, because they worship the god of war called Mars. And it convoluted into March. March. You know, different Romance languages, they pronounce it more like Mars. So Adar, as well as almost all the names of the Babylonian months, are gods of the Babylonian pantheon. They're Avodah Zarah. It's like when you say Thursday, and you're referencing back to the Norse mythos of Thor. It's all Avodah Zarah, right? July, the month of July, was added after Julius Caesar achieved god status. He was voted in as a demigod, so they named a month after him. Same thing with August, Augustus Caesar, right? And some of the other names were also like that. Monday is worshiping the moon. It was the moon cult. So same thing. Everybody did it. Everybody did it. The question is, how could the Jews go ahead and use in everyday language names of Avodah Zarah for their months? Right? It doesn't make sense. According to the Jewish tradition, this is a Chodesh HaShtemesrei, right? And what's Nisan? Chodesh HaRishon. Zeh Rosh HaRishon. Right? So that's the way you're supposed to refer to the months. Why did the Chachamim give like a general permission? It's okay, you could say it Adar, you could call it Sivan, you could call it Tammuz. Tammuz was also a cult.
Make it sound more special.
Right? No, to make it actually, to remind the Jews that you were still in Galus. That even though you're coming back to Eretz Yisrael, you haven't fixed everything. You're not there. This is not the final, for which one? Chodesh HaShtemesrei. That's it. There's no names, there's numbers. Because everything refers back to when we started as being a people, which is Nisan, which is the first month. Right. He also uses it to explain another idea, and with this we'll finish up this concept. So you're probably familiar with the holiday of Hanukkah. And you probably remember that the Chashmoneim were the heroes of the story, right? So it's true that they were the heroes, but according to the Ramban and others, they shortly thereafter became the villains. What did the Chashmoneim do wrong after their wonderful victory that we need to celebrate every year? Where did they go wrong? Anyone know? How long were the Chashmoneim ruling the land of Israel? Were they kings? Anyone know how long? The Rambam records that it was almost 210, sometimes it was 208 years. And then along came Herod and killed the last of the house of Hasmoneans. They set up a dynasty that lasts for 208 years. What tribe are they from?
Not Judah.
They are certainly not from Judah. That's exactly the point. Very good. No. Come on. Kohanim, Levi, Shevet Levi. They were Kohanim. The Kohanim, Shevet Levi, as well as Binyamin, and Gad, Asher, and Naphtali, are not allowed to be kings. Yaakov Avinu said that Lo Yasur Shevet Mi Yehuda. The scepter of power, of kingship, will never be removed from my son Yehuda. Yehuda has the only right to be king over the Jewish people. And therefore, the Ramban points out in his parish to the, in his commentary to the Torah, that what they did was an avera. The fact that they chased the Greeks out and rededicated the temple, that's great. That's what the Kohanim should do. Lead the fight to reclaim the temple. Great. But once the war is over, they should have found a follower, a descendant of Shevet Yehuda, put him in power as the new king, and they should have went back to the temple and got busy. Right? Now, why did the Chachamim object? You could say that if had they objected, then they would have gotten killed. But the truth is, the first couple of generations of kings.
Shaul from Shaul.
Good. So Shaul, at the next question. Shaul's from Benjamin. Anyone have an answer for that?
That is Ben David. It's when David becomes king.
Because
God is in David's dynasty, right?
Well, that's not the simple reading of Yaakov's blessing. Yes, Yaakov's blessing is that it can't be removed from Yehuda.
Right?
So it would seem to be.
Yeah,
but they didn't rule as kings. There was no Jewish sovereignty at the time.
So maybe Shaul was not like an official king. I mean,
Well, on the one hand, Shmuel did officially
do
the Shemurut. They anointed him.
Was that? They didn't have Yerushalayim at the time. Maybe that has something.
Okay, maybe. Good. It wasn't, in other words, he didn't have a complete kingship and then he was missing the heart. Very good. Yeah?
Hashem also chose Shaul. Hashem chose Shaul.
Well, people.
Yeah, he told Shmuel to do it.
No, Shaul. The people said they wanted the king.
Good. The people asked
him. Hashem chose Shaul.
No,
they wanted a king. It didn't matter who was the king.
Good. So let's do this. Let's put the pieces together. The people wanted a king. God chose Shaul. Hashem told Shmuel to anoint Shaul. Did God and Shmuel want a king at all?
No,
that's it. In other words, they shouldn't have had a king at that time. They were wrong for asking for a king.
Even once they were wrong, why would God have still made?
Okay, good. So it could be that when Hashem acquiesced to their request for a king, which was for the wrong reasons, because they want to be like all the other nations. So Hashem is basically saying to them, listen, I choose the king. I'm going to choose the king. All right? And it's got to come through a prophet. So listen to me. But it's right. This is Bidiyavid. This is not the way it's supposed to be. You should have waited until I told you to have a king. And this is, honestly, your punishment. He was a great man who had a tragic ending. But this is not the kingship it's supposed to be. So too, exactly, parallel. When the Cheshbonim set themselves up as a dynasty and they had king after king after king, so the sages didn't debate. They didn't argue. They didn't raise a whole big hullabaloo. What are you doing? You're not from Sheva Yehuda.
Didn't they become corrupt?
Yes, but the first couple of generations, they were very good and holy. So they would have listened to the Chachamim, and even had they not listened to the Chachamim, we don't see recorded in the Gemara that they objected.
So the reason they were punished didn't have to do with corruption. It had to do with the fact that they took the kingdom to begin with.
Yeah, I think the Ramban understands that was part of... It was part of the punishment. It was all, That since they were not fulfilling their role properly, they were doing something they weren't tasked to do, and that corrupted them.
Nachmanides.
So he says that they were punished for setting up a dynasty that they shouldn't have set up. Why did the sages object and say, "What are you doing? You're only Kohanim. Go back to the base of Megiddo. Leave it for someone from Yehuda." Because what would have happened had they appointed someone, a descendant from Shevet Yehuda, to be the king? What would the people have thought? They would have picked someone from the house of David, probably. Shevi Yehuda. People would have thought, this guy must be descendant of David Melech. Right. Shevi Yehuda. This guy must be Mashiach. And the Chachamim wanted to make it clear to everybody, Zelo Zeh. This is not really the full redemption. And therefore, there's a little island of Aramaic. The Jews kept the Babylonian names of the months. The sages looked the other way when the dynasty of Kohanim was set up instead of Shevet Yehuda. And when they rebuilt the second temple, they didn't follow Yechezkel's blueprints for the final temple because it was not the final temple. A radical explanation. He's not the only one who says it, but certainly something to think about. Something that when you say Halach Manya, hopefully, the Shana Haba'ah, it will be the complete Gula, and this is, you're totally correct, and we will be B'nai Chorim in the true Hebrew sense of the word. 100%. Okay, good. I'm going to give you a couple more vorts, and then we'll turn you loose to cut your nails, whatever. I'll tell you where to go next. We're getting ready to bake matzahs, that's why we have to cut our nails. Not because we're in like a cosmology. Okay. Another idea. Okay, this is short and sweet, but I like this one very much. Ooh, do I have a... need a marker. Yeah, that one helped me. A marker. Someone give me a marker.
I'll do that.
All right, I appreciate that. And an eraser.
Yeah.
Zev. Eraser. Would you do me the honor? Thank you so much. Okay, very good. Okay, so what are you supposed to do with the Russia? Kill him is a little strong. Now I can see that. Right, so the term is actually hakhei et shinav. Like the hakhot, or the kuf, means to blunt. To dull his teeth. What do you mean dull his teeth? What's pshat in that? Doesn't mean... hakhei et shinav. Right? He says, what's this whole avoda to you? What do you do with this whole avoda? give me a break. What do you need it for? Obviously, the problem is, as the Haggadah says, he's excluding himself, right? So he's saying, so you too, you haket chinav, you blunt his teeth, and you say, you know, you're right. Hashem did it for us. Had you been there, you would have deserved to be redeemed. Okay. So I'm going to share a beautiful little vort that I heard, that I read here from Shlomo Kalibach, and it's backed up by a beautiful beautiful piece of gematria. You ready? So if you notice, the Belzer Rebbe points out that if you notice that you're tefillin, there's two shins on your tefillin, right?
Three and four.
A three-pronged and a four-pronged. Anyone ever heard of any of the symbolism that has been applied to the three and the four? Let's hear it, Avi. Give me one, emotion, give me the other.
I've heard.
It's probably when you bar mitzvah, you kind of, people throw this up around. You ever heard, why is one shin three and one shin four? Right, for the Muslims, for the Abba, the Inor. Very good. Very good. That's one explanation. Excellent. Good. So when you look at the word Rasha, right? When you look at the word Rasha, so there's a Resh, on the end there's an Ayin, in the middle there's a Shin. So the Belzer Rebbe says, what you need to do with the Rasha is you need to Hak'e et Shina, which literally means to blunt his teeth. But also, it has the implication of to knock out his Shin. To remove his shin, what's his shin? Loosen up his shin. What's the shin? The three-pronged shin from the word shin, right. The three-pronged shin is reminiscent of the Avam Yitzvah Yaakov. And the problem with the guy is that the Ra is really external.
Wow, good job. Thank you both.
Right? The Ra of the Russia is really external. And what you need to do is you need to loosen this up a little bit and reconnect him with his forefathers so that he realizes that he has a Pintel Yid and he has, obviously, he's got some good on the inside, right? That's what the Belzer Rebbe said. And then Rabbi Yitzchak and Rabbi Yitzchak Mirsky points out the following thing. You ready?
Oh, man.
What is that equal?
5-7.
5-7.
The year that the big question was.
What's this one? What's this one?
10.
What's this one? Okay, 360.
366.
Okay. All right.
That's
a
math.
Do the math. 4.
1.
What's your number?
936.
Subtract.
204.
4. Is that right? You got that right? The math is okay. Right. Okay. I hope so.
I got a 70 in that class.
It's 100. That's another 100.
That's right.
And that's 4 points.
If you can loosen up the shin and take out the shin, then the Ra is gone and he becomes a Tzadik.
Oh, man.
Right. Oh, boy.
That's good. That's a sweet one, right? That's a combination of the Belzer
Rebbe.
You can turn him into a good guy, right? That's what Rabbi Nachman always says. You want to do kiruv on someone, just find the thing that he is good at and strengthen him.
Which is the only thing that kind of
this is for your own good.
Blunt your teeth.
What?
That's what you said.
Yeah, right. Very good. Ties us back in. Very good, very good. All right. One last four. You ready? One last four. So this is also from Rav Mirsky. This is a beautiful idea. So the four questions. You know, you loved it. You were 5 years old. You guys were probably cute as buttons. Stood up on a chair. There you go. Good, good memory. Good memory. Let me ask you a trick question. Ready? How many questions are there?
Four.
Right. Five or four? What are the four? You ready? First question. Mani
right.
Okay. Next question.
Maror.
Kulo maror. Right? Good. Next one.
Manu
Misubin. Right. Good. Last one.
Shemini.
Shemini. Matbilin.
Sharia Akot.
The
fifth one is.
You dip two times. We dip two times. Good.
This is the second one.
Check it out. Yeah? You got it? Kulo Matzah.
You should do a different one.
Yeah, forget about the fifth question. Just work on the standard four questions. Okay, so the truth is, it's possible to break this down into two questions. The little kid is looking around. There's a lot of things different. It's a little bit strange. He wants to know what's going on. He's sincere. He's a sweet kid. And he looks around and basically he's asking two questions. He's saying, listen, can we please make up our minds here? What's the theme of the evening? What are we trying to accomplish? Are we trying to go ahead and relive the misery and the suffering and remember the Avdus, the Shiabud, the slavery?
Yeah, I don't think my cousin's thinking that.
Are we? Well, right, well, there are four of them.
My time is 7 or 8.
You're catching up here. Or is tonight a happy night? Is it a happy night? And we're doing things that demonstrate that we are free men.
Happiness was the result at the end of the Haggadah.
That we had to do. Okay, so obviously, you know, we being adults, and only wealthy people dip their... we being adults are, and so we know the answer. The answer, of course, is that it's the same thing. It's the same thing. But before we have that and revisit that answer, it's actually a very good question, because we have precedent. If you look at, for example, at Purim, we have Tani Esther, and then the following day, not this year, but a normal year, we have Purim. Tani Esther, we relive, we remember the fact that they actually fasted 3 days. And they
were
we remember their moment of distress, gentlemen. And then the very next day, we go right into Purim. But if you note, it's two separate days.
Right, right, or in the Haggadah, you only have the transition from bad to happy in like one whole night.
Right, exactly. Now there's another precedent, which isn't, you know, hasn't been around long, but it's similar. What's the day before Yom HaTzimut?
Yom HaTzimut
is one of the saddest, it's one of the heaviest days of the year.
It's
good because, you know, the fact is, you can't appreciate the good without the bad, obviously. We don't want to dwell on the bad, we got to remember God's gula. But it makes sense to separate the two into two separate days. It makes a lot of sense, right?
Yeah.
So the little kid is looking around, he's like, well, we just had Purim. What's the deal? Are we happy? Are we sad? Are we celebrating? Are we reliving the suffering?
Yeah, or we're retelling the story, or we're sad in the beginning and then happy at the end.
Good,
so it's right. Kind of with Megillah a little bit. Where that happens in one
night. Good, very good, very good. So the answer is very clear.
Megillah is like the opposite. It's like, it's very sad in the end.
They were happy, they were cured. It did end with a, you know.
It's not like a happy ending, though.
I don't know about that, but okay. Okay. We celebrate. It was happy enough to celebrate. It wasn't perfect. Okay. Anyways, gentlemen, so we know the answer that obviously you can't appreciate the gula fully until you taste the moror, the bitterness. And we're not going to dwell on just the bitterness. We have to remember that God saves. However, there's one more stage to this. Yeah.
You could also say that. With combining the two, the first question would say that combining them by doing it physically.
Yeah.
The last two are symbolically we're doing something. You know, leading, but like things that it's
symbolic.
It's a physical thing, but it's much more symbolic than eating.
Okay, I hear that 100%. I hear that. Very good. There's a lot of ways to break this up. The neat thing about this this dichotomy or setting it up like this is that it actually is holographic. Meaning, within each thing is both things. You know, holographic, you cut it in half, you can see all parts of the whole in each unit. You know what I'm talking about? Even if you don't. So this is also holographic. What do I mean? Take a look. We don't have time to go through all four of them. But if this was the Shiabud, you know, the slavery... Right, and this was the Geula. Whoops. Then the fact is, if you look at each one, you find both within each one.
Oh, Avdut and Chayrut.
Right. What's the symbol of a matzah? Well, it's halach ma'anya. Right. Well, let's get rid of that one. It's lechem oni. The fact that they had to work and they had no time to even let their bread rise because the Egyptian taskmasters rushed and said, "Okay, I have to work. Have to eat it any way they had it." So it's a symbol of Shiru. It's also a symbol of the fact that we were going to redeem. The Shem told them about Rosh Chodesh, you're going to redeem, eat matzah. Why? Because the Shem knew that we would leave the Chippa zone. That just like they rushed us to work, the Shem was going to bring about such a destruction of the Egyptians, they would rush us to leave. And therefore, it's a dual symbol. Within the symbol, bitterness is both. Now, how about, that's an easy one. How about Moror? So Moror is they embittered our lives with the hard work. Okay, that's pretty...
Can we find the object on Misubin and Mabilin?
I'm going to leave that for your homework. All right?
That's pretty good.
We're running out of
I mean, they brought our nation
what's
together.
The, what's the
they brought our nation together.
Okay, you could say that through the experience as a nation of going through the slavery, it forged us together. Very good. How else can we see that the morrow, which is the they embittered our lives with hard work, also was a sweet thing? Let me ask you practically. What do we do with the morrow before we eat it? What do we do with it before we eat it?
In
the charoset. Why do we dip in the charoset? It's supposed to be
marrow. Because charoset is good.
Charoset is sweet. But wait, this is supposed to be bitter. Because out of the bitterness comes the sweetness. It is bittersweet. How do we know? There was good that came exactly from the bad. What was the time that was supposed to be in servitude according to the Brit-Bain of Tarim with Avram and 400 years. How many years were they actually in servitude? 210. They missed 109 years. So Chazal explained that because the Egyptians made it so bad, they compressed the suffering of 400 years in a period of 210 years. It'd almost be like if you took the Holocaust and you tried to figure out what would that be like in pogrom language, that would be like 2,000 years worth of pogroms. It was so compressed and so horrific that we were supposed to be there for 400 years, but we got out in 210 years, which means exactly because it was so bitter, the redemption actually came earlier.
The situation could have been worse.
The situation could have been prolonged 100%. And by the way, the difference between 210 and 400 is what? 90, which you probably know means that the case, the end, the Gemula, was brought earlier specifically because it was so good. Wow. Gentlemen, thank you for coming. Let me tell you where to go next.
Please tell me the soon. I'll be alive.
I'm hoping.